Let me begin by saying how deeply honored I am, of course, how deeply honored I feel to have been invited to give this memorial lecture, and by expressing my heartfelt gratitude to the persons and institutions to whom I owe this invitation. I doubt Robert Merritt would have sanctioned the sketchy exploration of varieties of individualism I'm going to present here, but he may have recognized something in the Kivaroan people's way of achieving individuation, something of the experience of the supernatural that he considered to be the threshold of religion. This, at any rate, is what I will try to show. Miguel Alioni, a Salesian missionary working with the Shuar of eastern Ecuador during the last years of the 19th century, had this to say about the Jivaro. I quote him, "Freedom of thought has no more limits for them than does freedom of existence. Each person is sole judge of his relation to others, executor of his own justice. The most inveterate customs have no force of law." And he goes on in his diary to wonder, what could be the reason for such a savagely individualistic way of life? This, in a nutshell, is the question I want to discuss here. Father Alioni's perplexity leads us straight to a classic problem of Western moral and political philosophy, and of course later of anthropology. What is an individual, and how do individuals combine to make up a society? This question is also classic in a more local sense, insofar as it lies at the heart of the works that mark the rebirth of Amazonist ethnology in the 1970s. Peter Rivière's seminal Individual and Society in Guyana, Thomas's Order Without Government, Joanna Overing's monograph on the Piaroa, Ward Crack's Force and Persuasion, and of course, Pierre Clast's Society Against the State. The central aim of all these works was to highlight the egalitarian ethos and the value of personal autonomy shared by the majority of lowland South American groups, as well as to analyze the sociological and political mechanisms whereby such centrifugal tendencies could be harnessed to produce viable societies. None of these pioneering studies has since been proven wrong or irrelevant. So why come back to the problem of Amazonian individualism? Well, for at least two reasons. The first is that our own, i.e. in very vague sense, Euro-American understanding of the concepts of individualism and of society have considerably changed over the past decades of post-industrialism, as a host of sociologists and philosophers have argued, from Agamben to Zizek via Ulrich Beck and Giddens. Consequently, the unspoken premises as well as the conceptual baggage we carry with us when dealing with other ways of articulating personal autonomy and collective life differ from those that underpin the work of our immediate Americanist predecessors. The second reason is that our understanding of Amazonian indigenous social formations has also considerably evolved since the early 1980s. We now have a clearer view of what kinds of subjects constitute these political economies of persons, as Rivière presciently labeled them, of how these Amazonian persons are produced, how they articulate bodiliness and subjectivity, and what kinds of relations to others they involve. So it might be a good time for attempting to reformulate our classic problem in a way that takes account of these changes and clarifies the differences and similarities between our brand of individualism and that of Amazonian indigenous peoples. In this regard, the Jivaroan groups present a useful case study because they carry to an extreme degree the tension between aggressively affirmed personal sovereignty and a strict conformity to a shared pattern of being and behaving. In fact, this is a trait that forcibly struck Western observers since the earliest contacts between Europeans and Jivaroans in the mid-16th century, not least because these Indians were very numerous, spread over a huge territory, and formed a seemingly undivided mass. The Miguel Alioni's comment is just one in the endless series of indignant and or bemused pronouncements on the Jivaro made by missionaries and officials throughout the centuries, beginning with the famous letter to the King of Spain written in 1550 by Hernando de Benavente, and I quote him, "In all these years I have been in the Indies," wrote the Spanish captain, "these are the most insolent, wayward people I have ever come across." And he went on to observe that, not content with being lordless, lawless, and rootless, they weren't even idolatrous since they had no religion at all. In the words of Juan de Salinas, another Spaniard who traveled extensively through Jivaroan land some 30 years after Benavente, the Jivaro, and I quote him here, "have absolutely nothing by way of belief but an abuse of dreams and a few bird songs." Though the stereotype of the Jivaro as insolent, murderous, and incredulous misanthropists was further and lavishly embellished by the missionaries during the following centuries, by the end of the 16th century, the term Jivaro had already become a generic label for rebels and delinquents of any ilk, a linguistic usage that has persisted in some Spanish-speaking Caribbean areas where the term is still used colloquially to designate outlaws. Of course, part of the opprobrium heaped on the Jíbaro stems from the automatic disapproval of a way of life generically labeled as beetría, a term that in colonial usage referred to any collective lacking a chief and therefore living in a state of political and moral confusion. But such a condition was far from unique to the Jíbaro. Many other upper Amazonian groups shared the same sociological features and were also labeled as beetrías. None, however, were so vilified and so persistently over the centuries as the Jivaroans. So there is clearly something more fueling the palpable resentment that comes across from the documentary record concerning these Indians, and this is a point I will return to further on. But first, let me draw a thumbnail sketch of the ethnic ensemble I am referring to, as described in the ethnographic literature of the first half of the 20th century. The Jivaroans form a very large population by Amazonian standards, now numbering well over 140,000 people. And until the 1950s, these Indians occupied a continuous territory roughly the size of Portugal, with few enclaves of non-Jivaroan inhabitants spread over northeast Peru and southeast Ecuador, and ranging over quite diverse environments from the high foothills of the eastern Andes to the marshy flatlands of the lower Marañón. This ensemble is subdivided into a number of tribes of varying size. The two largest groups, the Shuar proper and the Awahun, both numbering well over 40,000 people, occupy the western portion of Jivaroan territory. And to their east, they are bordered by the Achuar and the Wampis, each numbering between 6,000 and 8,000 people. These latter groups are themselves flanked by the less numerous Shibiar and Kandush. The ethnic bloc as a whole is, except on the Andean side, surrounded mainly by Quechua-speaking lowland groups of various denomination. All the Jivaroan tribes share the same pattern of subsistence based on slash-and-burn horticulture, hunting, fishing, collecting, as well as the same broad sociological features, widely scattered habitat in single polygynous households or in tiny hamlets of closely related families. Each household is surrounded by Swidden gardens and by a swathe of forest used for ordinary hunting, fishing, and collecting. These dispersed households form micro-regional clusters of interrelated families, gravitating around a man recognized for his capacity to act on others through persuasion, seduction or aggression. This man, called simply by a word meaning strong, powerful, or by a term meaning old and big, may sometimes pair with a shaman, preferably a brother-in-law or son-in-law. Such men, whether warriors or shamans, have no authority to issue orders or represent their group. Thus, falling in with their intentions hinges on one-to-one explicit or implicit negotiations. And what social weight these men carry is highly unstable. Feuding is endemic between such micro-regional clusters, resulting in high rates of mortality, particularly for men. At the same time, people belonging to the same tribe, that is to say, sharing the same language or way of speaking, more accurately, consider themselves as kin. The tribal unit thus constitutes the most extensive sense of the indigenous notion of my shuar or our shuar, that is to say, quite simply, persons. Tribal and more broadly ethnic endogamy is the rule. Members of other Hiveron tribes are held to speak differently and hence are non-kin and are considered on principle as enemies. And they were formerly the privileged and indeed exclusive target of head hunting expeditions. By contrast, relations with non-Hiveron indigenous people are normally peaceful, and along the border of the ethnic ensemble, there's a fair amount of slippage between Hiveron and Lowland Quechua identities. Now, before closing this very sketchy presentation of the Hivero, two very brief warnings. First, for reasons of space, I will not attempt to deal with the changes, vast changes, that have occurred over the past decades. And while I use the present tense, it must be understood that the ethnographic time I am referring to stems from my engagement with the Achuar essentially in the late 70s and early 80s. Second, and for the same reasons of space, in this talk I will focus exclusively on male processes of individuation, thereby adopting, in effect, the Hiveroans' own prejudices. The uniformity of Hiveroan culture is usually mentioned en passant in the ethnographic literature, but is nowhere discussed as such. It is treated as a given, and seemingly requires no analysis or explanation. Yet this homogeneity is quite remarkable given the size of the ethnic ensemble and its internal division, given also the Hiveroans' insistence on the essential difference between their own tribe and that of other Hiveroans. One would expect this distinctiveness to translate into stylistic variation, visible signs in fields of material culture, such as appearance, architecture, ornamentation of artifacts, and so forth. But this is not at all the case. In matters of dress and bodily ornamentation, all Hiveroans share the same basic repertoire, including their emblematic headdress of toucan feathers, and you would be very hard put to distinguish an Achuar from a Shuar or an Awahun solely on the basis of his appearance. It is true that there are fashions, both in dress and in architecture, playing on very minor details, but these variations solidify neither into tribal nor into individual styles, precisely because they spread rapidly from one man to another. These minor fads are also ephemeral and followed by a return to the standard repertoire. Accordingly, cultural drift is very limited, and indeed, judging by the descriptions recorded in the historical documentation, early 20th century Hiveroans looked and behaved very like their 16th century forebears. The same holds true for the limited range of artifacts produced by the Hivero. In terms of technique, form, and style, nothing distinguishes the baskets, hunting implements, textiles, and ornaments made by an Achuar from those produced by a Shuar or an Awahun, and few bear marks specific to the individual who has made them. This is not to say that these objects are interchangeable. They are in fact tied to their owner by a relation of obedience, somewhat akin to that obtaining between a master and his pet. However, this kind of ownership is not visually expressed. In short, all Quiberon adults produce, use, and own the same kind of artifacts, and all are presumed to possess the capacity for making them. Consequently, there is very little specialization of production for purposes of exchange, despite unequal distribution of certain types of resources, such as saline sources or certain types of palm trees or shrubs used to produce blowguns or house thatching. True, the western-lying Shuar had privileged access to steel tools and muzzle-loading shotguns, whereas many of the blowguns used by the Shuar were made by the Achuar. But these relative tribal specializations were contingent on transient historical factors and were never built up into the instituted scarcity and networks of intertribal exchange based on regional productive specialization commonly found elsewhere in Upper Amazonia. One also gains the impression that the Quiberons deliberately downplay the affordances for variation offered by the contrasts between the biotopes they inhabit. Philippe Descolas showed long ago that there is almost no difference between groups occupying fertile alluvial milieus and those occupying rugged interfluvial areas in terms of production, subsistence patterns, and lifestyles. And this pattern of leveling out the consequences of naturally given environmental variation extends significantly to the cultural shaping and marking of lived space. Regardless of their tribal memberships, individuals share the same repertoire of toponyms to qualify their territory, so that the label Big River, Canus, can refer, according to the speaker, to any one of the large rivers running through Quiberon land. Tooth can be any hill, just as muddy stream or stream of a certain kind of fish can refer to any stream. Hence the very confusing nature of the maps drawn up by foreigners relying on local knowledge, in which different rivers keep reappearing with the same name, including the name Tikichinsa, which simply means another river. So Quiberon place names form, in fact, a kind of movable grid of spatial coordinates available to all, rather than the reference points of a shared common space. But out of this shared background, as we will see, each adult male will carve a particular egocentric territory, singularized only by the memory of usage attached to it, in other words, by the life course of the individual it is centered on. In short, territoriality is an expression or even extension of individuality rather than the collective patrimony of a tribal or a regional group. Now, this is not to say that tribal differentiation is irrelevant to the Quibero, quite the contrary. As I said, from their point of view, other tribal Quiberons, being enemies, are maximally different. And this difference is expressed in linguistic variation, each tribe speaking a particular dialect claimed to be unintelligible to other Quiberons. However, according to linguists, dialectal variation within the Quiberon family is actually quite restricted and rests mainly on a few phonetic permutations, the lexicon remaining common, such that outsiders can very easily master the shift between, for example, Shuar and Awahun in a matter of hours or less. And in fact, despite indigenous claims to the contrary, in certain contexts, for example, in contexts of encounters between ritual trade partners, members of different tribes have absolutely no difficulty at all in communicating. So the difference in tribal speech is really an affair of presumed distance rather than a fixed objective fact. And far from contradicting the general uniformity of Hiberian culture, dialectal variation, linguistic variation, tends rather to confirm it, given its on-off nature and the limited as well as highly systematic permutations it rests on. To summarize, I would argue that Hiberian cultural homogeneity, instead of being a naturally occurring phenomenon to be taken for granted, is actually deliberately crafted and carefully maintained to block cultural drift and prevent the development of tribal specificities. What might be the purpose of this cultivation of uniformity? If we understand individuation to mean the process of singularizing an exemplar selected from a collection of things or beings sharing the same set of features, the notion evidently presupposes the existence of a common ground against which a singularity is made to stand out. And in light of this, I would suggest that Hiberian cultural homogeneity is created precisely in order to set up a certain kind of ground for the emergence of a particular sort of individual uniqueness. And this, of course, leads me now to Hiberian modes of individuation. The first requirement for becoming a distinctive person is bodily existence. This sounds absolutely obvious, but it is actually far from being a simple matter. It is widely agreed that Amazonian societies are predicated on an economy of persons rather than things. Being the essential wealth or central value of such societies, persons are therefore seen as a scarce resource. And this is because the ontology in which their cosmologies are based make no room for something akin to what we call nature. In other words, for a mechanism built into the world which automatically generates an endless supply of life and life forms. Persons have therefore to be built up out of material that exists in limited quantity and has to be captured, usually through some form of predation, bearing in mind that in Amazonia, persons are not necessarily human in our sense of the term, but rather any beings that may be endowed with subjectivity in given contexts, whether human, animal, or spiritual. Now, much has been written on this topic, and I won't go into the matter in any detail here. What I would like to stress is that in the abstract, there are really only two ways of conceptualizing this finite, vital material in an animist world. Either it can be conceived as a bounded supply of some sort of substance akin to energy circulating between individuals and species, such that a gain on one side means a loss on the other side. Or else, it can be conceived as a closed, given stock of forms or shapes constituting cycling potentialities of bodily incarnation on which to draw, again, in principle, in a zero-sum game, to produce a new person. This is the modality of vital scarcity that underlies Hiberian notions of personhood and principles of individuation. Each tribe, and depending on context, a tribe, this word tribe, can mean anything from a single household to a regional cluster or a whole dialectal unit, each tribe is conceptualized as a distinct species and, as such, must draw on the stock of person forms provided by its deceased members. Each one of these forms is intrinsically singular, like the cards in a pack, and the focal point of this uniqueness is, understandably, that part of the body we are, in fact, hardwired to look at, namely the face. Thus, every potential subject is inherently endowed with formal singularity, centering on facial appearance. This given singularity is then further elaborated in two different ways. First, it is enhanced by countering the risk of excessive resemblance between individuals belonging to the same collective through avoidance of twinship, and eventually, in the case of sets of siblings thought to look too much alike, by application of discrete differentiating tattoos. The same principles carry over into the field of onomastics, in that parents avoid giving to their child a name already borne by a living member of the group or family of reference. In cases of accidental homonymy, for example, when an in-marrying son-in-law has the same name as another local person, nicknames are resorted to, since changing a given name is seen as a sign of weakness on the part of the name-bearer. Second, as the still potential form is literally fleshed out by the cumulative memory of familial interaction and thereby progressively anchored into congenerity or humanity, a process constitutive of kinship, as argued by many of our Amazonist colleagues, it is further singularized by the embodied sedimentation of a unique relational history and thereby provided with the makings of an individual biography. But singularity of perceived form as of well, singularity of perceived form as well as of a bodily matter imbued with a distinctive relational history is still not enough to achieve the kind of individuality valued by Hiveroan men, though given uniqueness of form and of relational history is sufficient for children, for women, at least according to men, or for the kind of person they call a Nangami Eins, meaning a just-so or for-nothing person. What more, then, is needed to produce full male individuation? Essentially, engagement in a series of agonistic confrontations with human as well as non-human partners. The Hiveroans live in a world saturated with hostile intention, peopled with far more beings out to harm you than with loving and trustworthy persons. And this fact of life is drummed into children from their earliest infancy. By the age of 3 or 4, they will have learnt to fear adults foreign to their household, particularly adult men, and to be alert to signs of unknown and therefore menacing presence in their environment. By very early adolescence, at the same time as boys are freed of parental, generally more or less freed of parental disciplining, and left to develop their social and technical skills on their own, they will have experienced one or several frightening encounters with spirits while under the influence of mind-altering psychotropic substances, and will have learned to overcome or at least control their fear. At this stage, they will begin choosing their own dietary prohibitions according to the nature of the non-humans they are trying to relate to. They will start practicing ceremonial dialogue, a spectacular display of power through speech, though it will be some years before they feel strong enough to actually engage in one with an outside male visitor. They will spend a lot of time in the forest, honing their hunting abilities, and they will also begin to embark on sexual adventures, always a high-risk undertaking, given the strict control fathers and husbands exercise, or at least try to exercise, over their daughters' or wives' sexuality. A little later, and most importantly, they will start going on vision quests in the hope of interacting with a kind of spirit called Arutam, which simply means old or used thing. In fact, the spectral avatar of a deceased eminent Hiveroan man. Now, these Arutam vision quests are, so to speak, the pièce de résistance of Hiveroan ethnography, and I, as well as many other specialists, have written about them at length elsewhere, so I won't describe them in detail. These evidently harrowing experiences involve traveling alone in the forest, absorbing large amounts of a decoction of datura, as well as green tobacco juice and severe fasting, all the while summoning the spirit in song. If the spirit appears, it is first in the shape of a terrifying apparition, for example, an outsized warrior dripping blood, an attacking jaguar or a couple of jaguars, a huge ball of fire running towards one, and so on. The seeker must stand up to and touch this apparition, whereupon it explodes and disappears, only to reappear later in a dream as a spectral, vaguely perceived face who identifies himself and goes on to deliver a verbal or visual message predicting success, usually in war-related matters. From then on, the vision or message, indeed the spirit itself, dwells within the speaker, the seeker, sorry, as a kind of inner voice, imbuing his host with a sense of heightened purpose, clarity, strength of mind, and body as well, and the urge to kill enemies. By this stage, our young man will be ripe both to marry and to join in war expeditions. As a warrior, he will participate in various war-related rituals, again centering on simulacra of one-to-one martial confrontation. If he commits a homicide in the course of a raid, he loses his Arutam soul and must rapidly seek another one who will prove to be even more powerful than the preceding one, and so on, endlessly. The acquisition of a Arutam vision and the magnification of selfhood it brings about is indicated by subtle changes both in appearance and demeanor. In terms of behavior, it is demonstrated by heightened assertiveness in discursive as well as other forms of relating to others, and by ostensible willingness to engage in the practices proper to adult men, killing enemies in games and game, creating a family and independent household, seducing and taming women and animals. It is also signaled by the red geometric face painting men wear whenever they are visiting or being visited by adult men from different households or other local settlements. Such paintings, though they all look very similar, are claimed to be the same as those worn by the incorporated Arutam spirit when he appeared to the seeker, and as such are unique to their bearer. They are, in effect, the visible skin of the composite person he has become through the internalization of the enemy gaze, the spirit in his fear-inspiring avatar, directed toward the Arutam seeker during their confrontation. Given that the identity of the acquired Arutam must on no account be revealed, these face paintings are an exhibited secret, stating that their carrier is now a sort of half-enemy to his own tribe or family, therefore armed to resist their influence and capable instead of shaping others' dispositions through persuasion, seduction, or threat. The Arutam-enriched individual will then both expand and express his power through a range of social practices. He will gradually escape from his father-in-law's hold, He will acquire other wives and demonstrate by having many children his ability to produce persons by capturing unusual portions of scarce vital resource. By proving to be a successful hunter, he will manifest his ability to communicate with masters of game. By engaging in war parties, he will further magnify his selfhood, first by acquiring ever more potent Arutam spirits, and second, by broadening the circle of allies he may count on at any given moment to align their interests and intentions with his own. By this stage, he is well on his way to be recognized as a Kakaram, a strong man, a position that allows him to shape not only the social, but also the physical space around him by getting others to refer to its coordinates according to his account of it, by way of the stories of hunts, of near accidents, of strange encounters, whatever, the stories he tells about his engagement with it, such that the tooth or cave or river this space includes will henceforth be known implicitly as so-and-so's hill, cave, or river. And in the same manner, he will be enabled to narrate his own autobiography in the war-centered stories men tell to their family and to other men, thereby giving form and direction to the temporality experienced by the members of the group gravitating around him. His past and his depths of vengeance become theirs, as do his enemies, and therefore the future open to them. But of course, this capacity to impress his individual mark on the web of relations that constitute the lived world of his micro-tribe, this capacity is highly unstable and by nature ephemeral. The greater Kakaram, or Unt, old man, becomes, the more enemies he makes and the more exposed he and his family are to the threat of homicide and shamanically induced sickness or misfortune. At first glance, the Hiberoan's wild individualism may not seem so different from our brand of individualism, particularly the contemporary bootstrapping, do your own thing and forge your own selfhood variety claimed to be characteristic of post-industrial Western society. Both varieties assume that persons are driven to achieve some kind of exceptionality. Both feed on competition. And since Hiberoan society could assuredly be considered a society of risk, both entail existential precarity and uncertainty. But of course, there are major differences between them, both in the way they are constructed and in the type of individual they give shape to. To begin with, unlike ourselves, the Hiberoans are not at all interested in originality and claimed or real non-conformity as a means of standing out from the mass. They do not strive to be unusual Hiberoans, but rather exemplary Hiberoans, the best possible actualization of an ideal kind of identity. And becoming the best of Hiberoans means embracing conformity to shared norms rather than ostensibly despising them. Just as in Homeric Greece, it also means cultivating the heroic values of martial furor, tactical craftiness, and aspiration to a beautiful death in combat. It means strengthening rather than loosening the ties that attach you to a given community and web of kin, and thereby demonstrating an outstanding capacity to uphold the values central to Hiberoan lifeways, producing persons and killing enemies. In this respect, the process of emancipation held in classical theory to be a corollary of individualism and meant to free the individual from the unwanted attachments inherited by virtue of ethnic origins, class membership, or gender, takes an entirely different direction in the Quiberon mode of individualism. In their case, it implies escaping from a state of being merely an ordinary, just-so person, rather than escaping from the social particularity conferred by the circumstances of one's birth. In short, escaping from commonness by intensifying engagement in the core practices of one's community in order to achieve memorable singularity through exemplarity. Another salient difference between Quiberon and Western forms of individualism lies in their relation to property. While material property, possession, is in classical theory both the condition for being an individual and the expression of his autonomy, in Quiberon individualism, value is placed not in the owned things, but in the relation between the thing and its owner. The emphasis is not on property as the fruit of labor, but on the capacity to generate human and artifactual virtual persons who remain attached to their creator only if and so long as he or she can cause them to attach themselves to their maker. Property is thus an unstable relation between subjects and not an externality that can be detached from its producer or user. And this, of course, is why a person's possessions are, as is the case in many other Amazonian groups, are most commonly destroyed or abandoned upon that person's death. You may have noted that the achievement of singularity through exemplarity is conditioned by involvement in a series of more or less ritualized, agonistic interactions with human and non-human beings, considered to be of equal status, whether or not the partners concerned are actually of comparable social weight. In other words, all the relations deemed essential in the build-up of the kind of personhood defining true Quiberon identity are predicated on a principle of strict statutory equivalence between the terms, from the relation between brothers-in-law to that between Quiberon tribal enemies, on to that with Arutam spirits in their avatar as super predators. And intensive, cumulative engagement into these kinds of equistatutory relations is the source of increasing power to shape the dispositions of others, other men, women, game animals, and spirits, as well as to create new persons and thereby increase the population of the collective defined as my shuar, that is to say, my microspecies, my humanity. But the statutory equalization between the subjects involved in agonistic confrontation in fact sets up a relation of rivalry, and rivalry aims at one-upmanship. The whole point of rivalry is to produce a winner and a loser, in other words, a relation of inequality between partners initially posited as equal. In other terms, equalization is the condition for differentiating men on the scale of magnitude. But because proper Quiberon individuals are all presumed to strive for magnitude through competition and do so constantly, the inequality it produces is always in play and can never solidify into fixed positions of dominance. Achieved eminence automatically breeds challenge and thus carries with it the seeds of its erosion. Given all this, are we still licensed to speak of Hivaroan society as egalitarian? To become a memorable, magnified person means standing up to partners predicated as essentially different, but nonetheless identical to self in a kind of mirror configuration. If we consider the premise of equistatutory sameness between the terms of the relations on which the achievement of full individuation is built, as well as the inbuilt leveling of magnitude through challenge it results in, such that, of course, the unequal distribution of power is constantly shifting, it may indeed seem legitimate to label Hivaroan society egalitarian. However, if we focus on the outcome of this process of individuation and on the kind of equalization it involves, classifying Hivaroan society as egalitarian becomes, I think, a source of confusion. In classical political theory, at least from the 18th century on, the principle of equality between the individuals who make up society is defined in relation to a preceding state of inequality, whether this state is described in historical terms, as a feudal order, for example, or in terms of a theoretical state of nature ruled by unequal might, such as that posited by Hobbes. In short, equality as a value implies a move away from preceding inequality. By contrast, Hivaroan individualism is based on a move in precisely the opposite direction, from equality to inequality. I have argued that the remarkable uniformity of Hivaroan culture stems from a deliberate evening out or leveling of given particularity, such that all persons are granted, according to their gender, the same package of capabilities, dispositions, and ways of living, regardless of the disparities of physical endowments, as well as the differences between the environments they occupy. And it is against and out of this carefully crafted background of sameness that Hivaroan men forge their singularity by striving to become greater than other like men, thereby producing a society of greater and lesser, therefore unequal, persons. And I would surmise that the emphasis placed on ritualized agonistic interactions as a path to eminence and memorability reflects this very move from sameness to inequality, each one of these reiterated interactions reproducing in condensed form the move away from given equality to individual singularity. And it is also worth pointing out that these interactions, particularly the more ritualized ones, require a high degree of coordination between the partners involved. Both have to know and practice the same rules, and both have to rely on each other's willingness to allow them to perform their magnitude. And this has obvious political implications. While Western individualism holds that the production of society rests on the deliberative assembly of free, autonomous persons, governed by self-interest tempered by reason, Hivaroan individualism is rooted in a relation presupposing a shared disposition to coordinate while competing, something entirely different from assembly-based consensus. And here, by way of conclusion, we finally come back to the resentment against the Hivaro so persistently expressed by whites. Europeans and later Creole officials and mestizos brought to their engagements with Jivaroans an automatic assumption of superiority, at times explicitly voiced, and in any case, clearly expressed in their expectation of indigenous acquiescence to their authority. The Jivaroans, for their part, early recognized that representatives of the dominant society were and are powerful beings. As such, relations with them were assumed to be premised on the same principle of parity underlying the agonistic interactions through which they forged their individuality. But whites did not know how to play this game or refused to do so, because accepting this principle of equivalence would undermine the foundations of their identity as political authorities, men of the church, or indeed simply as members of the civilized society. To this fin de non-recevoir, the Jivaro reacted in a classic instance of complementary schismogenesis by ostentatious expressions of savage individualism, hoping to draw the white people into the same kind of relation of rivalry they developed with other powerful beings peopling their environment, and thereby turn them into proper partners as enemies and or as friends. But whites perceived this behavior as a cynical mimicry of their own attitudes and as demonstrations of insolence. Insolence, the epithet most frequently applied to the Jivaroan in colonial and early Republican times. And they came away from their encounters with Jivaroans feeling they were, to use a convenient youth speak term, feeling they were being systematically dissed by the Indians. As for the Jivaro, while they strove to be better than whites at their own game, they persisted in playing it in the Jivaroan manner. As a consequence, they were and are left dealing with powerful beings who are neither proper enemies nor proper friends. And this, I believe, is the tight knot of misunderstanding that to this day lies at the heart of relations between whites and Jivaroans. Thank you for your attention.